All right. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back to the Bokeh Photography Podcast. I am your host, Nathan Holritz. It's good to have you here today. Happy Monday to those of you that are live streaming with us. And if you are not, if you missed the live stream, you're listening to this after the fact, no worries, no big deal. But make sure that you follow us at Bokeh Podcast, B-O-K-E-H Podcast, on all the socials. And you can keep up to date with the upcoming live stream schedule so that you can come be part of the conversation. We'd love for you to ask questions, engage with myself and our guests, and give us a hard time if you want to as well. Today's topic is going to be one to definitely get into discussion about. And actually, on that note, I want to introduce a brand new guest on the show today. Miles Boyer is here with you. Miles, thank you for coming to do the show. I'm actually really stoked to have a fellow podcast host on the show with me.
Let's go. Dude, I love it, man. I'm excited to be here. Also, way to make me feel like a superhero with that lead-in music. I just feel awesome right now.
Well, for the longest time, we actually had something that was super low-key. I'm a pretty emotional guy. I'm a bit of an artist and musician, and piano is one of the instruments I play. So I tend to be drawn to that style of instrumental music. But I think for some people, it was a little too sleepy. And occasionally we get this comment like, hey, the music, not really digging the music. So I was like, okay, fine. We got to up the ante a little bit, bring something in a little bit more upbeat. So just for you though, just for you. That's the story we'll tell.
Dude, yeah. Go back to the sleepy music next week. Let's go high energy for this one. And then we can make it. Guys, so that you all know this is going to be the best episode. And then from this point on, it's pretty much downhill.
Downhill from here.
Yeah.
We were actually, so Miles and I were chatting before we got started. We happen to be fellow soccer players. I'm wondering how many soccer players might be listening in as well. Was that something you played all your life, or was it more like junior high, high school, and into college?
No, man, all literally. I mean, I think I have pictures that my parents took when I was like, it was the first sport I think I played. I grew up in New Mexico, right? So there is only soccer and tennis. You know, you have those two options, and so I played both. But yeah, I think I started when I was like 6 years old or maybe seven.
I think I was in very similar, actually. Well, maybe just a little bit older, fifth grade. So what is that, like 10 years old? Tell me if you can relate to this. I was like a little nerdy about the whole thing. I actually moved to Japan around the time that I was in sixth grade going into seventh grade. And so a lot of the training and the learning I did was over there in Japan, which Japan, baseball used to be the most popular sport. It transitioned a number of years ago into soccer. And so there was so much to learn from super talented players. But I would get up early in the morning. I'm like 12, 13 years old. I still have journal entries from when I would get up at early in the morning and go, you know, physical training and skill training, because I was dead set on this idea that I was going to play pro ball and I was going to put the work in to make it happen. And it didn't happen.
That's amazing. What a cool story, though. I mean, now you get to, you probably learned all kinds of things from that like early discipline, though, right? That you were able to take with you. So
for sure.
So, I mean, how many 12-year-olds actually set their mind to doing much of anything? So, you know, hats off to you. I think I probably had a much more typical, like, children's experience. I was just pretty athletic. And so I landed on a couple of great teams and didn't actually bother to put any, like, true effort into, you know, being a player until, like, probably early high school. When I realized it's not fun to sit on the bench, that was about the first time. And I was like, oh, it's more fun to be on the field. I should work harder.
Yeah, it's the hard work piece. That was something that, I mean, I've talked a little bit about it on the podcast here, and would love to get your take on this. You know, we were talking before we got started as well about the notion of ideals, you know, like we want to play professional soccer, and or maybe we're aging and yet we want to behave or be able to perform in a way that would suggest we're not quite as old as we actually are. But there's something to be said for ideals and pushing for ideals. Is there a point at which we have to like admit defeat and draw the line, or is it just an adjustment of perspective? Like, how do we maintain ideals but then function in reality simultaneously?
Dude, what a fascinating, when you figure out the answer to that question. I'm going to speak out of both sides of my mouth right now, because on one hand, I am I'm like the constant butt of every joke in my family, because I get hurt every time we go on vacation. I get hurt with something, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that. Like, broke my leg at the beach, dislocated my shoulder skiing. There will be an injury of some kind, and all of those injuries stem from me acting significantly younger than I really am. But On the other hand, I'll say, I think that the perspective of a little bit of age comes with the joy of like starting to pass on that stuff. Hmm. It's why I, you know, as a dad, I'll say that, like, I find so much of my identity in being a dad. Because now both, for instance, now both my boys play club soccer and I get to coach one of them, which is super cool. But, I have the opportunity now to see them try and take on, you know, courageous moments where they're losing and they're trying to get it back, or they're just trying to be brave. There's something lost in our culture about that. That those feelings of like not only going after the win, but battling through the loss. And I don't know. I mean, if it means I have to get hurt every once in a while to show my kids that I'm still human, I guess it's worth it.
I thought you were going to say show your kids that you can still take them, but you were going the human direction.
Also that I can still take them. I mean, yeah, both. I'm not going to lie. My 11-year-old, he won't listen to this episode, which is the only reason I'll admit this. I think that my 11-year-old, he can definitely outpace me. I'm not exaggerating when I say that. But I think that my 11-year-old might actually be able to like just outskill me with a soccer mm-hmm. ball these days. Yeah. I don't know why. They're just better than we were.
Yeah, there is a certain, I mean, the bar continues to go up further and further. I ride motorcycles and I follow motorcycle racing pretty closely. And, they're mm-hmm. talking about the drop, quite a significant drop in time for this particular track that they were racing over the weekend, just in a year's time frame, by a second and a half to 2 seconds. Performance, oh, wow. I mean, as our technology continues to improve, both, I mean, certainly in various industries, but even when it comes to our health, as technology continues to improve, we have this ability to be able to continue to raise the bar. So what we thought was just incredible back in the day now is like, we're just kind of shrugging our shoulders and looking for the next thing. But I think, what a relevant statement though.
Oh, no, go, please.
No,
go
please, ahead. Please.
Well, I was going to say, what a relevant statement for like our industry in the sense that like, I can remember very clearly, man. Like I remember my very first digital camera with my mind just being absolutely shook. And it's like, grabbing a camera even from 3 or 4 or 5 years ago that I'm like, this thing is unbelievable. Nothing will ever beat this. And then, the next camera comes out and it sort of feels like the education level of the kids in our industry. I sound like such an old man right now, but that like the camera that I'm shooting with is the first camera they've ever had. And so they're like amazing right out the gate. I'm like, this is cheat codes. This isn't fair. Like I had to learn how to play the game with a camera that, fell asleep in the middle of a wedding. Right. And now here you are. Yeah.
Yeah. Times change, tech changes. I think at the end of the day, just kind of bring it back around. And before we get into some of the talking points for today, I think it's good to maintain a certain level of ideal. The last thing, and I'm sure you can relate to this, Miles, just from our brief conversation, I sense this in you, but last thing I want to do is just to kind of be status quo or kind of play to the average. And there's something to be said for pushing and for raising the bar and for being above average in some form or fashion. It's something that I strive to do. And I want to encourage our listeners to do as well, whether it comes to their personal life or their business life. I think it's always good to just push beyond our comfort zone a little bit. It's a value of mine. I can sense it's probably a value of yours as well.
Yeah, I absolutely. 100%. We left a quick training this morning on one of my small groups that I mentor that was encouraging everybody to understand that there's an incredible difference between evolution and change, right? So often, like culturally, we like to use those two words as almost synonyms. But the example that I said is like, you can change your underwear. You can't evolve your underwear. Evolution has to be this slow, methodical, intentional process. And it happens by you setting your eyes on a goal that you want and then working with purpose and perpetually just sort of digging away at that goal. And evolution happens and you didn't notice that it was happening. Hmm. And so I think if you're setting a goal for yourself, you're setting a benchmark for or an expectation of excellence for yourself, and you don't pull up on that expectation, then you evolve into an excellent version of what you were trying to do. But most of our industry wants to light switch it. They want to change. They want to decide, hey, we're going to go through a branding shift. We're going to switch from Sony to Nikon to Canon to whatever the new thing is. And we're going to call it evolution. But the reality is all we're actually doing is just changing before we've had the opportunity to even see what great would look like had we just stayed in our lane for just a little bit longer.
But I wonder though too, if, I mean, our industry's tendency, what I've seen, and I've certainly been guilty of it, it's very easy to be in a reactive state. So, you know, we're just trying to keep our head above water to get the next session or the next wedding, to make ends meet, maybe put a little bit of money aside. The idea of reaching beyond that growth takes a certain level of intention, and a reactive state of mind isn't going to enable that. We have to kind of move beyond that. Why do you think it's so easy to be in that just kind of reactive state where we're just moving day to day, just trying to get things done, and we don't tend to want to push beyond that? I don't know if it's an innate desire for most people.
I mean, I think that courage is something that you don't see enough of in business owners, and maybe a lot in creatives, simply because there's this this sort of general perspective on the fact that, like, if you have a camera and you can take great pictures, success will somehow be a byproduct of those things. And then we get into this business and we realize that there's any number of things that we didn't learn, whether we were in film school or, you know, going through like a YouTube university. There's any number of challenges that you weren't expecting. And those are the challenges that tend to derail us. And so rather than, you know, forecasting those challenges and trying to get out ahead of them and making, you know, tangible, real moves towards courageous things, you know, becoming successful, planning for retirement, understanding that, you know, like, winning an award doesn't necessarily raise the value of your work to your clients. All of those things take guts. And it's a hard thing to encourage young creatives to be courageous outside of just, you know, new ways to compose an image or new ways to edit.
Yeah, but that's a safe space to be in, right? It's it does require being, I mean, you talked about having guts, being uncomfortable in order to move beyond that kind of box that we very easily live in day in and day out. And by the way, again, this is not a judgmental conversation. I've been guilty of this time and time again. It's very easy to stay where we're comfortable. But if we're going to kind of reach that next level, if we have some ideals and we actually want to achieve those, we have to be willing to step outside that comfort zone. The analogy I like to use a lot of times is skydiving. I've been a couple of times. Have you been before?
I haven't, man. My wife made me say that I will never skydive. That was one of our, I don't know if I would call it a prenup, but it was basically a prenup. It was like, yeah, you're never going to jump out of a plane on purpose.
Fair enough. Well, all I'll say is that from that experience, it's very easy to build up the extremity of the experience in our head, and understandably so. But when you make that leap, you realize that this thing isn't as crazy as you built it up in your head. And then the experience on the other side of the willingness to take that leap is like nothing you've ever experienced before. I mean, I literally had a physical buzz for probably about 45 minutes after we landed. It was the craziest thing. Again, if we want to reach toward those ideals, we have to be willing to take the leap, to step out that comfort zone and do something that we're not used to doing in order to have or to be able to achieve some version of that ideal. And I just want to encourage everybody to do that. I mean, we had the conversation 2 miles about you know, wanting to play pro ball. And I can say in hindsight very easily that I didn't, as much as I wanted to play, and I did put the work in, and maybe in unusual ways even, I didn't push as hard as I needed to in order to achieve that goal. Mm-hmm. And so in hindsight, I look back and I'm like, man, yeah, I had the skill set, but the work ethic, as good as it was, wasn't good enough. I didn't push myself enough. I wasn't willing to step beyond my comfort zone in order to achieve this thing. And moving forward in my life, the last thing that I want to do is look back and say yet again, oh, shoot, I just didn't put the work in, you know?
Yeah, what a great statement, though. I mean, I think the easiest thing that we can do is look back in short periods of our time and look back and say, like, were my goals big enough? It's so easy, I think, often to look back and say, like, I didn't work hard enough. But to challenge ourselves to say, were my goals big enough? And if they weren't big enough, then how do I forecast over the next, you know, 2, 3, 5 years to make bigger goals? maybe just reaching, and this isn't a knock on any of this, but maybe just reaching for a rangefinder rising 30 isn't a big enough goal for you. Like maybe being an endorsed photographer isn't a big enough goal, because I'll tell you, I run in those circles every day. I mean, those are my friends, and these are people that have, they struggle with the same levels of insecurities as do I, as people that have been in this industry for 15 minutes. Having goals that rise you above simply professional success. And so, like, I would say right back to you, something maybe as quick hitting as skydiving for you became something that was like, this is an experience that's going to push me, and then on the back end, it's going to change me. And I think that just having that perspective allows you to change the way that you build goals and the foresight that you put into shaping how big those goals really are.
Yeah. I think a lot of times when we don't have perspective, it can be difficult to set those types of goals, right? This is such a loaded topic. I want to park here, and I know we've already been going for like 15 minutes and we haven't even touched what we plan on getting into. So we're going to, we'll set this aside for now. Maybe we can come back to this in another conversation. Shout out to Michael Davis, who has actually been on the show previously as well. Michael said, waiting just a little bit longer to see what great would look like. I love it. And then he followed up with, we have to be comfortable with being uncomfortable in order to push these boundaries. And yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And thanks for chiming in, Michael. It's great to hear from you. And for anybody else who's live streaming, don't be shy. Jump in, comment, ask questions, join the conversation. We'd love to have you part of it. And to that end, Miles, I want to jump to, I know we talked about kind of riffing off each other, but I do have a few questions I want to ask you. And a few of them are just kind of shotgun style, very quick, rapid fire questions. And I want to start first with something that may seem a bit cliche, but I think is really at the heart of a successful photography business, especially in 2023, and that's customer experience. Photography in and of itself, if just to summarize it simply, is a bit of a commodity, right? At this point, it's not so difficult to take a great picture anymore. So the question is, how do we keep the bar high enough in order to continue to charge a premium for portrait, wedding photography, et cetera? Customer experience, I think, is a lot at the center of that. I'm curious if there's a principle behind the customer experience you provide your clients that has enabled you to do just that.
Yeah, 100%. Although I know I'm going to offend people when I say this, but hear me out with this. This is a service industry at its core. And what I mean by that very simply is that 90% of people, let's use a wedding for example, 90% of people at a wedding will never see the photography, but they all will see the photographer. It's a service that you're providing. And as long as you make this about you, success has a very low ceiling. The moment you learn to make your client experience truly about your client, setting parameters, of course, to protect yourself creatively and legally and just, you know, your joy in your life, those are important things. But the moment you make this truly about serving and not about taking, that glass ceiling is absolutely shattered.
The word serve or serving service is not one that we use a lot in our industry. I'm actually a huge fan of it, and I think we need to kind of put more emphasis on it. What's behind that? Like in your mind, when you think about serving your client, what does that look like tangibly for you?
Yeah, man, it's a mindset, which is, again, that's a word that we throw around too much, but it's really more like a posture, like a heart posture to say like, hey, your needs in this moment matter to me. So you may have hired me to be the professional from a perspective of like capturing these moments, but that doesn't mean that that's all that you need. I can serve you in any number of ways, whether that's the fact that I may be or likely am the only one in any room that has been to 600 weddings, right? So my perspective on weddings and timelines and building and planning, all of that stuff is really valuable. But it also can be something along the lines of, you know, if I serve my clients well into respecting and appreciating their relationships, the byproduct is more authentic photography and more composed moments, as opposed to more what we would say in all our training is more posed moments.
Yeah.
And so I think that simply by having that posture that says like your perspective, your goals, your heart here matter to me, it allows us to be set up to create then a product on the back end that has the service as well as the client's needs baked into it.
Mm. I've only known you a few minutes, Miles, but I like you already. I love the emphasis on service, and it's not something that I hear a lot in our industry, unfortunately. And I think it's good that we continue to put some emphasis in that conversation. Service is another value of mine, and the way that I have it defined for myself is making someone's life just a little bit better. And I know that's mm-hmm. very vague and broad, but it is very vague and broad. There's so many different contexts in which we can make somebody's life a little bit better. I can go through the Walmart, you know, the checkout line at Walmart, for example, and actually talk with the cashier and call them by their name and ask them how their day is going and do so with intention, which literally translates to the tone of my voice and the look in my eyes. And they're like, oh my goodness, somebody just paid attention to me. It's amazing how that mentality, that intention, going back to that word again, that intention drives the experience that we're able to provide for the person on the other side of us, whether it's for 30 seconds or 30 minutes or 12 hours on a wedding day.
Yeah, well, and I mean, to put it simply, most of our industry, like, you know, one of the, I think probably if you could run analytics on like the most Google searched things that photographers are trying to find out, surely in the top 10 of those things would be how to become a luxury wedding photographer. Like that's the tagline right now, right? It's like, how do I get into the luxury market? Well, I will tell you this. The easy answer is you have to be humble enough to serve people that can afford to be truly capable of hiring anybody that they want. And your service now, it comes down to the fact that your product and your client experience and the way that you humanize them is all packaged up into one experience that then they get to digest. But you don't get to practice that on a wedding at a luxury event. That's not the appropriate time to get good at that. You have to practice that at the grocery store or with the bank teller or with the waitress that got your order wrong. That's when you practice humanizing and serving and taking care of people. And then you take those experiences of being, you know, humble and still confident and aware, you take those into your professional life and you'll see the general demographic of your clientele rise right alongside it.
Love that. Okay. So I'm going to shift gears. Our podcast is primarily focused on helping photographers build sustainable businesses, i.e. businesses that don't burn them out, gives them freedom, flexibility. And of course, in order to do so, we have to think about how we manage time. And I'm curious to learn from you a little bit about an idea or principle that's enabled you to manage time more effectively as a photography business owner. I see you starting to grin there a little bit, so I'm even more curious now.
Well, okay. Again, I'll say that, and I feel like I say this too often. Two things can be true at once, right? You can both appreciate the importance of being efficient as well as the value in being inefficient. I've said this a number of times in my podcast that efficiency is where creativity dies. That when you are so focused on getting from A to B that you aren't willing to grow in the process, the art starts to wither. And so I think the appropriate way to start talking about time management is in compartmentalizing the parts of your life that need to be efficient and the parts of your life that need to not be efficient. Now, I sound like a complete expert right now, and let me digress quickly by saying I am at times a poorly organized person, but it's not for lack of trying. Over the years, we have spent so much money on trying to like purchase CRMs or different calendar systems or different, you know, things, digital things that help me with time management. And what I've learned, to be honest with you, is that the more analog I can keep my life, the easier it is for me to just keep up with things. And so I've gone back now to being, my best ideas are, you know, scratched down in journals. And my to-do lists are, you know, have a physical check mark next to them. And again, I'll say that the idea of time management has to come down first to just a level of discipline and a level of priority. This is a whole sidebar here, Nathan, but we heard an interesting stat the other day. Jared, who's one of my business partners, mentioned this to me. He said that prior to the early 1950s, the word priorities as a plural word wasn't even in the dictionary. And I think it's a fascinating statement to say that as we have learned that we've tricked ourselves into this idea that we can multitask, we've also tricked ourselves into the concept that we can juggle different priorities at the same time. The reality is you're going to be able to do one thing at a time and doing that one thing well means that you have to have the discipline to carve out time to get other things done either later or before it. So it just takes putting in the work, man. You know, there's not a, you and I were talking about running before we started recording. You don't get to set off at the beginning of a 13-mile race or a 26-mile race and finish strong unless you've put the work in. And you know, most of us as business owners are so quick to look for shortcuts. You know, how do we buy the next preset pack that's going to make our life better? You know, how do we purchase our way to success? That we forget that a lot of the people that we most look up to have found success by really grinding through the hard stuff and coming out stronger on the other side.
So many different directions we could go here. So when it comes to the idea of going analog, I mean, I understand with digital tools that we have so much wonderful access to, a lot of times there's this paradox of choice, right? There's so many options and features and we get caught up in the option features instead of just getting the work done. Is that kind of what you're suggesting, is the importance of going, at least for yourself anyway, going analog so that you're not as distracted in the process, or what's the actual benefit?
100%.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, 100%. So there were years in there, in my career where I would set goals for myself each day, right? Like, I'm not going to bed until I edit 500 photos, or I'm going to do emails from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Or social media is going to be limited from, you know, 9:30 to 10, and then again from 1 to 1:30. All of those things, I think, are in and of themselves great goals. But what it took me a few years to kind of get optics on was not the fact that I had built fairly sustainable goals for myself, but the fact that I had built goals at all was unique. And so, you know, I think that there's a number of processes that any photographer can take. It's just sticking with them for long enough to see the fruit show up from those processes. So when I switched to a more analog lifestyle with time management specifically, it was things like, you know, how do I grab my notebook? How do I immediately, you know, start the day off by looking back and saying, what is it that I didn't finish yesterday that I had a lot of intentions on finishing? Because that's probably a great place for me to pick up and get and make sure I start today. But then also reworking the list to say, okay, what is it that I need to get done today that I can't afford to let go until tomorrow? And again, I mean, like, Google search this and you end up with a million perspectives on this. But most of those perspectives, at least in my opinion, they take people further away from just getting things done, right? Like, oh, you should split your page up into fourths or into eighths or all of this stuff. And it's like, man, if people would spend the same amount of time just getting crap done that they do worrying about getting things done, it would all already be done.
It's so true. It really is so true. Okay, so I could easily spend an hour or two here just on this topic with you, but just one last follow-up question. When you are choosing then what to spend your time on next, can you share with our listeners just a little bit of perspective on how you're making that choice? Because I know you've got your hands in a lot of different things, and I do as well, so I can very much relate to that. And it would be very easy to fill my list immediately with 68 different things, right? But we can't. As you pointed out so brilliantly, it's not priorities, it's a priority. What is the priority at hand? How do you make that choice?
Well, okay. Again, now that's a more tangible thing. That comes down to those goals that theoretically we set earlier, right? So we set a goal of saying, for my business, perhaps, I set a goal of saying, I would like to be able to charge significantly more than I charged last year. But in order to do that, that allows me to free up time with my family. So now I have to create a better service process for my clients so that I can justify that rate. And when I'm not working, I have to now put my money where my mouth is and actually spend more time with my family. And so, you know, the time process starts for me with where those goals are and how I built those goals. So specifically things like, how do I delegate out things in my life that don't bring me any joy whatsoever and that I can afford to delegate? So, you know, a clear perspective, one of the things that we do a lot of trainings on is like, how quickly can you go from no accountant to accountant? Unless you just have a gift for juggling and managing your money, there are people out there that are passionate about managing your money, and they really won't charge you that much of your money to help you do that. So delegating out things like your accounting, your taxes, perhaps your editing load, if it doesn't bring you joy and it's not actually helping to grow your brand. And then with that free time that you just freed up, now how do we utilize that time to be more productive and more effective in the time that you do have? And so again, what that came back to for me is I want to serve this industry. Wholeheartedly serve this industry. And so now I found myself with additional time because we have offloaded a number of things, whether that's by working with a higher demographic and taking on fewer events or you know, whatever. And with that additional time, now the goal is for me to be able to pour some of that time back into the industry, into serving photographers, into guesting on podcasts, into hosting my own podcasts and my own training programs. And making sure that my team and our employees and everybody are not only well managed, but well catered to and taken care of, that their families are happy, that everybody is being taken care of. And all of that starts by setting those goals, that priority list up, and checking every day, you know, if health, which I would argue should be a major emphasis of any small business owner, if health is a priority, what did you do today that was focused on being healthier? If you wake up with anxiety problems and these heavy burdens, what are you doing to recover and rest better? If you see your relationship as something that, you know, your marriage or spouse or partner or whatever, as something that there is an opportunity there to strengthen, what are you doing today to help that relationship scale in a more healthy way? And you know, we've got to start at the top every single day. And I would argue even in every single hour, you've got to restart at the top, make sure that you're staying true from an ideal perspective to where you're dedicating that time.
Yeah. And I'm glad that this theme has continued through our conversation today, because it really is. It's so important that we all have some level. I refer to it as a big picture view. We've talked about it quite a bit here on the podcast, but an overarching set of goals combined with your values and your strengths that drive what it is that you're doing day in and day out. And unfortunately, again, and I also speak from personal experience with this, it's very easy to get into business and not start with that. It's just like, oh, I want to be a photographer. And okay, now I need to make this much. And oh, shoot, I need to make sure I book enough to make that much. And that's kind of the focus. And we're just responding and reacting to communication through the day. Yep. And it becomes kind of a haphazard existence without that North Star, which is our overarching, again, what I would call a big picture view, but that overarching set of goals and our values that are driving our decisions. And I think it's really important that we start there. It's something that I practice on a regular basis, Miles, which is to start the day with reviewing my values. I have 12 in particular that are important to me, but that acts as a North Star for me in my decision-making process and how I'm living my life day to day. And it naturally filters what I do spend my time on, don't spend my time on, what I'm prioritizing, what I'm making a big deal, you know, personally or professionally. Like it's so important to start there. I have to push back a little bit though. I'm curious to get your take on this, because you talked about the importance of goals, but then you also said not only are you using that as, or that we should be using that as a frame of reference for making decisions, but then also whether or not it brings us joy. And I've heard this a number of times from photographers. And the reason I push back is there are a lot of things in my life that bring me so-called joy. I like to ride my motorcycle. I like to watch a movie on Netflix. I like to go to the beach, whatever it is. Just because I enjoy something doesn't mean it's necessarily a thing I should be spending time on. And again, I can filter for that based on my goals. Where is that balance between doing something because I enjoy doing it and doing something because I should be doing it?
Well, okay. I mean, I guess we could get in deep into the semantics here. But I'll tell you, I think we actually sort of agree in general. I'll say this. At least from my perspective, I'm seeing a difference between the way that I view happiness, a moment that makes me happy. Eating ice cream makes me happy. Joy being a long-term, again, I would use the word a posture. That there's this posture of joy in your life. And that takes itself into how you're serving your family, how you're serving your industry, you know, how you're showing up. Now, I'll tell you from a very tangible perspective, at least in our brand and in my job, I've spent years now with a very focused process on educating my clients into my values, making sure that they understand that though they are important to me, there are things in my life that are more important to me. And so if they do text me at 10 o'clock at night, not only am I not going to feel guilty, but I'm not going to feel obligated to get back to them at that time.
Right.
You know, if they do come back to me and say, well, we can only shoot on a Sunday, I'm not going to feel obligated to cater to their schedule because I don't work on Sundays. And that's something that, you know, we have spent time educating instead of drawing these hard lines that I think a lot of small businesses do, where they set these firm parameters and then they feel defensive. Again, there's sort of a general posture there of like scarcity in that defensiveness. Like, you know, okay, my time is so scarce and I have to protect it. The flip side of that coin is finding joy in humanizing yourself to your clients and telling them, like, guys, I cannot wait to be a part of these moments with you. But in order for me to dedicate this much time and this much passion to you, I'm asking you to understand that there are also things in my life that I'm passionate about that I would love for you to find joy in with me. And I spend a lot of time with my clients, you know, sending us gifts and presents to my kids, or, you know, a thank you note that includes a, you know, $10 gift card to take my boys to ice cream and stuff like that is, yeah. It's just a sign that we're doing it right. Mm. But again, I think it all comes down to that. I hope I explained that well. That joy for me is a long-term process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all kinds of things that are unhealthy make us happy.
That's fair. Well, one of the main reasons that I push back is because one of the arguments that I've heard over the years, owning an editing company myself, of course, is mm-hmm. that I edit my images because I enjoy it. And while mm-hmm. the sentiment makes sense, I think it's a little bit short-sighted in that if we're just doing things because we enjoy them, and I'll come back to your point about semantics here in just a second, because I think it's important to distinguish between the concept of joy yeah. as you're describing it and just so-called happiness. But if we're making decisions based on what makes us happy in the moment, whatever makes us feel good in the moment, which is a cultural tendency that we have, then we're going to make, in some cases, the decisions that don't actually support, even if they're, either whether conscious or subconscious, our overarching goals. We're doing this thing because it feels good right now. Oh, this, I love playing with this Lightroom preset. I love making these images just so, because it just makes me feel good. It makes me feel like an artist. Okay, fine. But is this enabling you to build the business that is going to reach those overarching goals, to meet your financial needs, to be able to spend more time with your family, your friends, your partner, whatever the case may be? I'm not sure that spending time, and I pick out editing just as one example, but there's so many different examples of this where just because we enjoy it doesn't necessarily enable us to be able to live our best life per our goals. And that's why I'd like to make that distinction.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly well said, man. I mean, I think editing is one of those early on decisions that photographers often outsource. In my opinion, they outsource too early sometimes because they've yet to develop enough of a stylistic perspective in their work that whoever that outside editor is carrying a whole lot of pressure in brand development that I think is not necessarily fair unless that editor is in-house. But it's also one of those things that photographers tend to hold on to for too long. And they become, you know, their ego gets wrapped up in the fact that for some reason, something that they're doing, the proprietary element to them is in their edit. And there's a whole lot of insecurity there and a lot of ways that we could unpack that. But I think that the reality is that eventually, if you want to be a full-time photographer with a really hustling and bustling, you know, career at this in 2023 and beyond, you're going to have to realize that this industry shifts and evolves and kind of reinvents itself every few years. And partnering with other brands just in general, whether that is editors or, you know, it's color science brands like presets or, you know, being more committed to, you know, to the gear that you shoot, just having accountability and community is going to probably be the fastest and most safe way through that jungle as it shifts and changes.
I think words at the end of the day matter, and it's why it seemed a little bit picky, but I think it's also easy in our industry to kind of throw out phrases and words at times that are repeated then over and over and over again, and the meaning, the significance of them gets lost, especially as it relates mm-hmm. to the individual. I know that in our culture, a lot of people will say a word and it means one thing to them in that particular context. And another person says it and it means something to them in that context. But in that process of those meanings getting watered down, then we potentially miss out on how that thought process associated with that word or that phrase or that sentence may actually be affecting our lives personally or as business owners or maybe a combination of both. And so, yeah, I tend to push back a little bit when it comes to words. I love that you make that distinction of joy versus happiness and the significance of joy as a deep-rooted, long-lasting sense of really a fulfilling happiness, if you will. That's at least how I understood it growing up. And absolutely. So I appreciate you making that distinction. Again, we could park here and spend a lot more time on this, but I want to go ahead and jump into what I intended to kind of make our primary focus today, which is a conversation that I don't think has been really delved into a whole lot in our industry. And I'm curious to do this with you, Miles. You're obviously a very thoughtful individual. As we were discussing what to talk about on the podcast today, this was a topic that came up, this idea of imposter syndrome. And I hear this, these words and this phrase kind of thrown around quite a bit in our culture in the last 2 to 3 years, culture in general, but certainly in our photography industry. And I'm curious where you think that's even come from. Why is this more, I guess, widespread as a topic in the photography industry in the last few years?
Well, I mean, I think there's a number of reasonable answers to that. I mean, I would say first and foremost, you mentioned earlier that photography has become a bit of a commodity. I think alongside that comes all of these different on-roads. People are you know, you don't have to go through film school anymore. There's not a 4-year degree or longer associated with being a photographer. And because of that, now there isn't accreditation behind that word or that title. And people feel a lot of insecurity when they don't have a title that feels accredited. And so, you know, I would say that it's this sort of juxtaposition or this internal battle between doing something that you love and that you know that you're good at, and then feeling like other people are likely better than you are, or maybe they are more proven than you are, or perhaps just their on-road was more official than yours was. And it's a very real thing. Often we kind of poke fun. I'll say at my podcast, a handful of times we've sort of like joked towards the idea that often people with just simple insecurity about their work, a lot of times we'll call it comparison complex, not imposter syndrome. They will jump into this idea of feeling like such an imposter. And in reality, I think that actually the insecurity of one's work is something that really can be a healthy thing towards driving you to doing better in general.
Yeah.
But the syndrome element then takes over. And at some point, people get into this sort of death spiral of realizing that it doesn't feel anymore like they're actually good at anything. And so, you know, their work isn't good enough. Their editing isn't good enough. You know, their client experience isn't good enough. They're not priced high enough, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they're still booking. And it's in the but that is don't take that out. But it's in that section that the problem shows up because people make that connectivity and say, I am broken. I'm flawed. I'm a fake. I'm a phony. However, other people don't see that and they're hiring me anyway. And so now I have to live this lie, and it's the gap. Let's use that, not the but. It's the gap between those two things that I think the problem lies. And man, I mean, there's so many simple solutions to that, but I would say first things first, understanding that there's a key difference between a complex or maybe insecurity and the development of that insecurity into something that would be considered more of a syndrome, like a spiral, and catching it early, is probably the key component that people just aren't doing. So you in a very real way, you do end up with people that are just, man, they're frustrated and they are down about their own accomplishments. And you know, by the time they feel it, it's hard, it's a whole lot harder to get them out of it.
I guess I'm still trying to figure out though what, and I'm not even necessarily asking you specifically, I'm just thinking out loud here, like what mm-hmm. was it in our industry that created this obsession over the topic? Because ironically,
Instagram.
And not even Instagram, you think that's what it is?
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. Were you a part of during the pandemic, the kind of Clubhouse, the few moments, the 15
bit.
Minutes of fame on Clubhouse?
Yeah, a little bit.
So myself and a couple of buddies, Tom Wright and Igor Denba, hosted a show that got pretty popular with the industry for a few weeks. And one of the big topic conversations was imposter syndrome. And we were asking that question over and over again. You know, where is this coming from? And everybody that would raise their hand and then unmute would say, well, I've spent my days these days because I'm locked inside. I can't go out. I'm living inside a bubble, you know. And so I spend my days sort of missing the outside world, and I'm living vicariously through the back-posted photos of other photographers who are clearly so much more talented than I am. And so people were backdating their emotional experiences. And they were saying, well, I'm stuck inside, but all these other photographers are still posting photos from Moab and from Iceland and from Norway and from Thailand and all these places that I have yet to even go. What happens when the quarantine opens and the floodgates release, and now everybody knows that I was stuck inside as a phony without cool work, and these other photographers had so much to give to the world during this time period? And man, we just ended up in this spiral where social media became even more artificial than it was before. And now I think at a cultural level, it affected our industry, perhaps forever, if I'm honest.
But when I see, and we could easily kind of fall into a death trap here in this conversation, I realize, but when I see, just as one example, if I see a male model who's just ripped, you know, all the abs, all the muscles, super fit, that doesn't make me think I'm less than, as in like I go into this depressive state where I'm like, oh, I'm just not good enough, so I might as well go eat cookies. If anything, it's going to make me, it'll give me something to aspire to work toward. So, and I realize that we're wired differently for different reasons, and so this is going to be a very subjective conversation, but it just seems as though there's this tendency in our industry to go to the worst possible place rather than looking at it as an opportunity. And I don't know. Is that really just Instagram? Because it seems like there's this shift, not only a mental shift, but also then we've grabbed a hold of this phrase, imposter syndrome, and people that maybe never would have used that word, those words or that phrase before, suddenly they're just throwing it out there because it's the thing to talk about having. I don't know. I'm very confused about it. I don't even know where to go with it.
We popularize insecurity. It makes it easier to be self-deprecating when everybody does it together. I'll say this, there's such a lack in general, there's such a lack of community. And you're going to hear me say this a lot throughout the rest of this topic, but there's such a lack of community and a lack of accountability that often we try and find approval in isolation from other people who are isolated. And that's just a problem in general, I would say. But, you know, you're right. Most people are using the term, I'm not a psychologist here, but I would say most people are using that term incorrectly. But that doesn't really matter. The situation is the same. To your point, though, I think we also have to admit often, we also have to have the perspective that any number of life situations and cultural and societal influences have affected people before those symptoms start to pop up. And so to your, you know, point, you know, you may see a male model and it be actually motivating to you. I would say the inverse of that is if you've spent an entire life feeling like you aren't good enough, then this can simply just be like another brick on the house of not being good enough. Mm. Only now it's your career, you know? And so it feels much, much larger than, you know, oh, I too could go out and get a six pack if I wanted to. Well, now it's like, you know, everybody else feels better than I am. Everybody else looks like they are more educated and more knowledgeable than I am. I am a true fraud at everything that I do. And I will say there was a number of months in there where I was pretty hard on the concept in general. I really was pretty difficult on it. And I can be a little crass, especially in our training things, basically saying like, hey, you kind of got to suck it up, Buttercup. Like, you've got to get out there and put the work in. Nobody is going to put the work in for you. But then I was kind of quietly educated by a number of photographers that I really respect and really appreciate their perspectives that said, that being said, Miles, you do have a cultural lens that is that of a college educated, very confident type A personality, white man, right? Like I have this lens on that any number of other people may not be looking through. And I need to be a little more sensitive, at least in how I address it. Although I don't necessarily think that means we need to be sensitive to the topic. I think that we should be encouraging people to get out there and just make work that they're proud of and find community in groups of people that'll help hold them accountable to their own goals.
Hmm. Okay, so a couple of follow-up questions to this then, because I think it's, you said earlier that some people are using this phrase incorrectly and that doesn't matter, but I would tend to push back again under the guise of focusing on semantics, because this is the thing about words. We say words, and one, it can confuse conversation and communication between individuals when we don't actually know what that other person means when they're saying that thing, right? But then there's also the internal psychological component, which is if we're saying this word and we're just repeating this word or this phrase over and over and over again, and maybe we placed a particular label or definition on that word, or maybe we didn't. But whether it's conscious or subconscious, we keep using that thing. It could actually be pushing us down the wrong path if we're not actually aware of what this thing means, and then more importantly, where it comes from. I think there's a component of responsibility associated with, really a lot of the common conversations or topics in our culture and in our industry at the moment, which is not embraced. And so when I see that somebody else is not, somebody else is better than me, for me, because I take that sense of responsibility for making my life what I want it to be very, very seriously, and I realize that's where I'm going to get the results, I don't see that as, it's not a source of depression for me. It's more a source of motivation, because I'm like, oh, somebody else made a choice or a series of choices that enabled them to get to this place. Yeah, sure, some genetics played in. Sure, their environment, their circumstances may have given them a boost, but at the end of the day, they still got to make the choices in order to be that person, that business person, that athlete, whatever it might be. And I think we've thrown a lot of that out, and that's part of why so many people are in a death spiral into this topic. But when you say that people aren't using the phrase correctly, are you talking about a distinction or a definition that is different than what most people understand it to be?
I mean, perhaps. I think often we actually just did this. We sort of inadvertently, we sort of took a right-hand turn off of the topic of imposter syndrome and started talking about problems with self-esteem. Right. So it was like ideas like, oh, you know, maybe I'm not working hard enough, or I'm not as good, or I'm not as talented. I actually pulled up here just because I think this is really interesting. Pulled up the Wikipedia definition. It says, awesome. Imposter syndrome, also known as imposter phenomenon or imposterism, is a psychological occurrence in which an individual doubts their skills, talents, or accomplishments and has a persistent internalized fear of being exposed. I think it's the second part of that is actually the most important part that we forget.
Okay.
Everybody often feels insecure or maybe has those battles of self-esteem, right? Where they say like, man, I should be better, or I could be better, or why does my work not demand a higher dollar, or et cetera, et cetera. We all have those moments. It's that second part of that definition where it says there's a persistent internalized fear of being exposed as a fraud. I think that's the differentiation, is that fear that not just that you have insecurities, but that anybody's going to find out about them. And that's why I would point to Instagram, even though this isn't like me dogging on Meta. I do plenty of that anyway, but we've culturalized, we've popularized the idea of living about as artificially as possible. You know, to the term of like even face tuning ourselves, right? Like our biopics are now so highly edited that nobody has any idea. Nobody has any clue who you are, what you're actually interested in. You know, I used to poke fun again in a lot of our trainings. We would call them the Labradoodle Society, right? Like every young female wedding photographer immediately goes out and buys the wide brim hat and the Labradoodle and the latte, and then takes a picture with her mouth open laughing. Because we have so popularized what it looks like to be a successful photographer that anybody that falls short of that ideal is no longer a successful photographer. The problem is that very few people, if any, actually live up to that ideal. And it is in that fear of being exposed, I think, is the reason why it's become such a popular topic, because a lot of us in general, but a lot of creatives walk around, you know, with their stomach all tied up in knots. What if anybody finds out that I'm not nearly as cool as I make myself look? And dude, I'll put my hand up. I mean, I'm actually really dang good about making myself look really exciting. Sure. And then at about 9 o'clock every night, I'm like, man, I'm ready for bed. So, I mean,
I'm guilty too, but I think I'm glad that you pulled up that definition, and this is where the value of so-called semantics, it holds true. And that is, we actually understand what this phrase means originally, right? I understand culture tends to shift and adjust meanings, definitions. I think, again, that can be problematic. We'll save that conversation for another day. But in this case, it has to do with fear of being found out. And this is part of what's been so confusing to me. I'm like, okay, so if you have imposter syndrome, as you pointed out, the actual definition refers to a fear of being found out. What are you doing behind the scenes that is so guilt-inducing or fear-inducing that you're afraid of being found out? Like, how bad is your photography? How bad are you as a business owner? Or are you actually just building this thing up way bigger than it needs to be because of the insecurities, the other kind of component to the conversation? But I just don't understand why people are so afraid. Like, if you're living such a terrible life behind the scenes, then maybe you have something to be afraid of. But otherwise, why are we afraid of being found out? Like, we're all trying to figure things out as we go. That's the case for pretty much everybody, right? So if that's found out, so, okay, fine. We see the images in Lightroom before they're edited. Not so great sometimes. Okay, yeah, and so is everybody else's. So why are we so afraid?
Well, I wish I had the answer to that one, man. I mean, we've spent years now educating and kind of pouring into photographers. And the one thing that I will say, whether photographers specifically or in the film industry or just really creatives in general, a lot of us think we still have this mindset that our value as humans is in that finished product of the work. Only we've now started to try and connect ourselves at a brand level to the work. So our faces now have to be a part of the product. Well, now what happens when you take a person that is inherently insecure about, you know, their acne or their hairline or their weight or you know, a speech impediment or any number of things, and you imply to them that the value in their product, the value in what they offer to clients, is in hiding as many of those things for as long as possible until they sign the contract. You know, and so you end up with people. I end up with this as a podcast host frequently. I end up with people that I deeply respect, but that won't be on my show because they aren't articulate and they're scared of how they sound over a microphone. And when I come back to them and I say, but your perspective, your work, your experiences are incredible. I'll hold your hand through this. Let's get through this together. They're too insecure to walk down that road with me. And these are people that are, you know, highly established in the industry. And so I think at a much lower level, a much more approachable level, you know, we're trying to tie together psychological concepts for a, you know, 45-year-old mom who used to take pictures of her kids and has decided this is going to be a passion of hers. And now she wants to be in business, only she's now competing against a 19-year-old who is largely uneducated, but is absolutely gorgeous and beautiful and playful and silly. And she's competing against a 35-year-old, you know, dad that's been doing this for 20 years. And I mean, these psychological concepts are so broad that we talk about them because we can all appreciate the value in our own lives. So even if we don't quite understand them, I think we can sympathize, or I hope can sympathize with people that are juggling with them without enabling that to become more of a problem in their lives. And so again, I'll come back to the power of community. I mean, if you're not surrounded by people that expect more out of you than moments of insecurity, then, you know, you're hamstringing yourself.
You touched on something earlier that I think is fascinating, which is that photographers' identities are tied up in what they're doing professionally. I see business as just something that I do. It's not quote unquote who I am, which again is another rabbit trail that we could go down. But like this idea of giving so much significance to this one thing that we happen to do in life amidst many, that we tie our identity to that. You're absolutely right. I think that's probably a big part of why it can be so easy to go down that rabbit trail and get caught up in that sense of, I guess, imposter syndrome. I hate it for people because I mean, the idea of being afraid of being found out, it's going to be so uncomfortable. And so maybe let's just kind of use this as a segue then into some specific ways that you would suggest photographers might be able to face this head on, to be able to kind of step beyond that sense of imposter syndrome and ultimately be able to make the choices that will enable them to move forward. How would you suggest photographers do that?
I mean, I think first, before I even like segue directly into those little pieces of advice, I'll say, I think it's important to get a grasp. Let's use you as a perfect example. All right, we've known each other for all of 45 minutes at this point, but you've mentioned a handful of things to me that I think are really critical from your perspective, right? So you love to race motorcycles. You were a high level athlete and you've skydived and thought that there was a thrill, there was a piece to that. My point there is you have a high level, a high threshold of risk to pain. And I don't mean physical pain. I have no idea how you are with physical pain, but the idea, the psychological concept of pain doesn't outweigh your ability to take on risk. And so I think that's important for people to kind of grasp that because, you know, I mean, it's clear, it's easy for me to say, okay, well, here's three things that you should do to step outside of this. You know, first, get healthy. If you're not healthy, nothing in your life is going to fall into place. And I don't mean get aesthetically healthy. I mean, get to a point where you're sleeping well, you're eating well, you're active, you're getting plenty of fresh air. Like you're living a life in which your body is enjoyable to be inside. And then second, surround yourself with positive community, with people who want the best for you, genuinely want the best for you, but need you to also contribute. They need you to want the best for them as well. And so there's a mutual accountability in which your success empowers theirs and vice versa. So that when you do have bad days or you do have rough experiences, you have people that are willing to not only hold the line for you, but help pull you back up to it. And then third, I would say to get at every given opportunity to get a fresh perspective on what success actually looks like for you. Because we love to throw around in this industry this idea of like, well, if you can just get to six figures, you'll be successful. Well, I hate to be the game kill here, but in most of the country at this point, if you can just get to six figures, you are above the poverty line. You have to have a more clear concept as to what success actually looks like for you, and then create a roadmap alongside your community inside of a healthy lifestyle to which you can get there. And if you can do those things and have a appreciation, maybe, but at least a healthy respect for your risk threshold, where you're at from a pain perspective, then you've stepped outside of the entire concept of imposter syndrome, and you've walked away with all that you need for a healthy career and people who love you, and a long life.
Wow. I mean, that was very presidential of you, actually. It was an impressive presentation.
That's it. Mic drop.
Mic drop. No, I'm totally playing with you. Actually, the way that you summed it up is quite powerful, but I'm one of the things that I'm kind of stuck on is, and I'm taking notes kind of old school style here on my notes or in my notebook.
Analog.
There you go. Yeah. From a very digital guy, by the way, when you talked about the importance of being healthy, getting comfortable with yourself, but then ultimately being healthy, I think a lot of what would enable someone to avoid this sense of imposter syndrome is being clear about not who they are, because that can actually change. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very much a misnomer, but who they want to be, who they intend to be mm-hmm. on a day-to-day basis. If they're actually clear about that, that will also enable them to do the thing that you suggested later, which is the definition of success. So now they're deciding what it is that they want to do in life, what they want to achieve in life. That naturally would translate to their business. And part of that conversation internally is about what success looks like, what it is that they want to achieve. Now they are now making these decisions for themselves. And then, yeah, that the hard work of having to kind of work backwards from that and figure out the steps in order to accomplish that. But now the narrative is from themselves. It's not from the outside. It's not as a result of, you know, comparison on Instagram or whatever other platform that they might be spending their time on. They're actually taking responsibility for the life that they want to create and trying to figure out the steps to get there, versus letting the outside world just kind of dictate to them what success is, what it's not. By the way, all this obsession around high-end photography too, it's a small market. Everybody wants to go to that top 15, 20%, while there's also this massive other side of the industry and opportunity that lies there. But nonetheless, I think that taking that responsibility really, really makes creates a drastic shift in perspective that enables then people to take the steps necessary to step outside the box, to make the change in their life. I can from the outside, you talk about kind of creating this facade, from the outside, I can sound like just a really cool guy, skydiving, you know, tried to play professional soccer, races, motorcycles, whatever. But I'm deathly afraid of heights. I could be on a platform that was 50 feet above the ground, and that I'm freaking out. I'm shaking, I'm sweating. Mm-hmm. My attempt to go skydiving and ultimately the trip to go skydiving was an effort at stepping beyond that and making a decision, taking the responsibility to do something that would face that fear of heights. And so now I'm jumping out of a plane at 15,000 feet. I used to be super overweight, 40, 50 pounds more than I am currently. It was ultimately my responsibility to take on the task of making change in my life, mentally, physically, in order to get to a much healthier place. So yeah, from the outside, it might look like this guy that's just willing to take all these risks and do these things. But the reality is I'm a super emotional guy who, when I allow those emotions, those so-called feelings in the moment to take control, I'm a fraction of the person that maybe people perceive me to be. It was the willingness to take that responsibility to make change that enabled me to make really significant change in my personal life and my business life and to create the life that I currently have. And so I know I'm kind of jumping around here a little bit, but I think it's just really important that we're willing to take the responsibility to create the life for ourselves, maybe just as a starting point, to go back to your original point. If we're going to get healthy, part of that is being clear about what it is that who you're trying to be, what you're trying to achieve. And if you start there and own the responsibility associated with that, we're going to be in a much, much better place mentally. Otherwise, we're going to just continue to be driven by the outside narrative of the world. I'll stop there. I'm rambling a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think that there's, you know, again, there's any number of conversations that then spin off of this. You know, some of the people that I've known in my life that have appeared to be the most healthy have really just been the most vain. And health has been an outlet for them to express their insecurity. Mm. You know, a lot of people that I know, especially in our industry, that are maybe known as the most successful, are truly the most isolated. You know, they're people that you would assume because of their success, they have everything in the whole world. And in reality, they've spent, you know, more anniversaries and kids' birthdays on the other side of the world alone than they have with people that love them. You know, I just think it's important that I keep using that word humanize, but we keep coming back to the table and saying, it's the reason why I'm so outspoken about this idea of community, but we keep coming back to the table and saying there is absolutely nothing to be gained. There's no benefit whatsoever for creatives trying to go this alone. It's too big of an industry and we don't have to do it anymore. But in lieu of accreditation and, you know, the 4-year degree and the number of remarkably talented artists out there that have kind of found their own lane, it's okay for us to speak up and say, you know, like, success doesn't happen either A, overnight, or B, only to people who look and act and create in a specific way. And there's absolutely room for your work at the table of success. You're just going to have to find a path to get there and a group of people who want it bad enough to pay for it.
Well, but if we start by defining that for ourselves, isn't that the healthy place to start? If we're clear
it's
about
2/3 of the work right there.
Yeah. If we're clear about who it is that we want to be as an individual, and as a result, then the business that we're trying to achieve that in some part supports those kind of personal goals. And then two, if we have, as a result, defined that success, then again, the outside narrative, as I so ineloquently said earlier, was trying to get to earlier, the outside narrative no longer has that kind of pull on us, the weight on us that it currently does. If we are just reactive in nature, we're like, I'm going to be a photographer. So I start the photography business and I'm just in it and trying to make ends meet, trying to make this thing work. But then I'm constantly reacting to everything externally. It's going to be so easy to be swayed and ultimately get really down in that process because I'm not clear about A, who I want to be, and B, what I'm trying to achieve. All the other conversation seems like it would largely go away if we've established those things for ourselves. But by the way, I didn't mean to skip over the other point, which I did note that you made about surrounding yourselves with community. I have to say, in the last year and a half, I've been part of a mastermind that has made a massive, massive impact on my life. And really what it comes down to, it's mastermind sounds so grandiose. It's really more of an accountability group, right? An opportunity to share what it is that we're going through, what it is that we're trying to achieve, certainly getting some encouragement, some support, but then also having people that are close enough with us, they'll play hardball and say, Nate, you need to change your attitude. You need to do something different. Your approach, your mentality, your perspective on this is very limiting. And having that kind of challenge. So both the support and the challenge that comes from community probably will help us like snap us out of that, I don't know, that this other world that we live in that unfortunately is limiting us as an individual and as a business person as well. So I'm glad that you highlight that. I think it's so important.
Yeah, I mean, I think that just the way that you speak about it is massive. Just the perspective that you have to say, like, you know, you found a community of people who are all very different and have a different set of goals for themselves, probably all have different looks and aesthetics to their work and certainly life experiences. But the thing that you have in common is a mutual goal of supporting each other. And there is just something lost in the industry as a whole about that. And a big part of that is because the barrier to entry for most of the industry is very low, but the barrier to entry to those groups can be fairly high, at least in, you know, relatively. It can be pretty expensive to be a part of those groups. Mm-hmm. If you want a seat at the table, you know, it's very much a pay-to-play situation. But the reason for that is because accountability isn't free. And that's a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people. YouTube education is free. Accountability and community in general costs something. It costs, at bare minimum, it costs your time. More than likely, it costs your time and some money. But I will tell you, before you go invest in, you know, in a waterfall workshop on the edge of the world to pad your portfolio, you need to invest in people who actually care about your success.
Yeah. Shots fired.
You know, Patrick, I mean, sure, I guess, but you know, again, a lot of those people, they're friends of mine, but I tell them that as well. I'm like, you don't need 2 weeks in Iceland looking like a professional photographer only to come home with bigger imposter syndrome than you left.
Interesting.
I mean, that's where this stuff starts, right? You came back telling the lie that look, here's what my work looks like in Iceland. No, it's not. This is what happens when professional models are also flown to Iceland and you all stand in front of Skogafoss and you act as though there weren't 2,000 other people shooting photos.
Yeah.
And guys, I've been a part of that lie. I don't know how many times. And one of my favorite weddings I've ever shot was in Iceland, but for a real couple that took us there to do real work. Just live in the authentic, do the real stuff, put in the work, make real relationships with real vendors. build meaningful moments between you and other humans, and then allow your photography to just be a byproduct of surrounding yourself with memories. And man, your clients are going to, they're going to trip over themselves to get into the line of that. Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to fake your way through it, the best you can hope for is that the clients that hire you don't know that you're faking it until they've already paid.
Hmm. Okay. First of all, you just summed up our conversation in the span of 30 seconds beautifully. And I'm just going to leave that untouched. I do have one follow-up question to what you just said, though. You know, the fake it till you make it phrase gets thrown around quite a bit in positive and negative ways, both. But where is that line? If we're talking about behaving in such a way, again, which you just summed up so beautifully, behaving in such a way that we have no reason to be afraid of, quote unquote, being found out, which is really at the root of this mm-hmm. idea of imposter syndrome. If that's the intention, where is the line, the balance between, I'll take a personal example. When I went to photograph my first wedding, I had done my research. This is back in 2000, 2001. I had done my research. I'm reading books. This was pre-YouTube, you know, mm-hmm. and all the other stuff. So I'm reading books. Maybe I took a couple practice rolls of film, but I didn't know a whole lot. I just gained a bit of perspective and I went and took pictures at this wedding. And fortunately, long story short, it worked out really, really well. And I ended up building a career from it. But I didn't know everything at that point. Was I faking it till I made it? No, I just had limited knowledge. I had a certain amount of knowledge. I felt like it was enough to go take the pictures at this wedding. And then I continued to build on that and get better and better. Where's the line between faking it till you make it, i.e. I'm selling something I don't have, and just the simple reality of being an entrepreneur, which is I have to learn as I go. I'm going to continue to get better.
Man, what a great question. Again, I mean, I said this, I think it was WPPI last year speaking. I just made a statement that I don't know where it came from exactly, but I was talking to the fact that there's any number of genre niches, right? We could, that's a whole other podcast topic here, but any number of things with a camera, that are very specific, incredibly specific. If you're a food photographer, if you are a headshot photographer, if you're a newborn photographer, commercial photographers at the extreme high end, macro photographers, a lot of these things are extremely tech extensive, right? And so the analogy that I used was almost like being you're a heart surgeon, right? You have to know inside and out what's going to happen when you cut the chest open. Being a wedding photographer is much more like being an ER doc. You've got to know that you're going to just need to make the cut and save the life, even though it's probably going to scar kind of badly, and they're probably going to go need to see plastics after they heal. The talented wedding photographer is somebody whose skill falls just as much in building relationships and dealing in high pressure situations as it does in how to use a camera and lighting. And so I would argue with you that you probably knew a whole lot more about wedding photography than you think you did. Not based on those books that you read, but based on a life spent, building relationships. And you probably walked in much more capable of serving people and solving the problems as they showed up. You just may not have had the technical skills yet. That being said, I mean, the idea of like fake it till you make it. Listen, I hate pretty much any cliche like that anyway, because I don't want my made it to have anything to do with having faked it. I want when I make it, when I succeed, I want to be able to sit back in my chair with a really great scotch and say, I did it. And if you're faking it, then often I think you're probably, again, kind of standing in your own way. Now, that being said, there is always going to be an element, as a creative, always going to be an element of trying to take on things that are outside of your comfort zone. And, a perfect example, I've used this in a number of trainings as well. Jason Vincent is a good buddy of mine and actually lives kind of right down the street. Anybody that knows Jason knows that this is a dude that somehow he just creates unbelievably creative work using light that I don't even know how his mind works. Now, knowing that and knowing him personally, it certainly doesn't excuse me being scared to death to pull out a flash and put it on a light stand. And it doesn't mean that when I do that, I'm faking it because I'm not as good as him. It just means that I have a perspective on what great can look like. And then I have an angle on what good is going to look like for me today. And you know, sometimes I get really lucky in those situations, but I think it's okay for you to have perspective on people that are better than you at things and still have the confidence to know that you are likely a whole lot better at other things than maybe they are or were when they started.
Yeah. I mean, there's, I can't remember where I originally heard the phrase, but it goes something like, there's levels to this shit, right? Like there's always levels.
Yes.
At the end of the day, there's always going to be somebody that's better than us. And rather than fixating on that, let's just figure out how we can get step by small step a little bit better and really revel in that. And I know it's a mindset shift. And it's a bit simplistic to suggest that people just go do that. But I can promise to everybody listening in, just from personal experience, again, that the amount of joy, we'll use that word, the amount of joy that comes from prioritizing, valuing growth, again, small step by small step, will enable you then to go take the risk to make the changes necessary to see what you've defined as success. Not what everybody else is defining success, but what you've determined looks like success for you. I just want to encourage everybody with that. And by the way, a couple more comments have come in. Blacksmith Print Company said, yo, my boy Miles from YouTube, and Brady Perrier said, love Miles. So thanks for the comments, guys. And for those of you that are live streamed with us today, and for those of you who also took the time to comment. Miles, you've mentioned community a number of times, and I know that you also host a podcast. I'd love for you to, we kind of did things backwards today. I didn't really introduce you officially when we started the show. We'll kind of do that here on the tail end. Will you share with our listeners a little bit about what you're involved in addition to being a photographer, the community that you're building as well?
Yeah, I will. And thanks for that, man. Genuinely, thank you so much for the platform. Just the opportunity to speak, and this has been it's been a powerful and not simple conversation. I know often on podcasts, I feel like the interviews tend to come down to very much, you know, tell your story and at what age did you pick up your first camera and things that largely don't matter. Sure. And this is a conversation filled with stuff that it matters. It's gonna affect people's lives. And so thank you for creating that, you know, that space for us to talk. So I run a community called the Photographic Collective. Founded that alongside a number of very close friends. And we're active right now building out our own platform, which is a pretty exciting thing to take everything off of Meta and away from, you know, forums and stuff like that, and kind of have our own space, which is really exciting. For more information on that, you can just go to photographic-collective.com and sign up. Right now, it's free to join. It won't be for long. And so, you know, simple plug there. That being said, I also host a podcast alongside my good buddy, Jared Fincher, called the Photographic Collective Podcast. And, you know, we tap into some pretty incredible guests, into a lot of conversations very similar to this. A lot of mindset coaching and business coaching goes on in there, as well as then doubles over into the community and into the small groups that we lead and what we call triad training, which is 2-to-1 trainings. So all of that is going on perpetually. And then beside that, I run a brand that's just Miles Wood Boyer Photography. Pretty flattered to be a part of the Fujifilm global ambassador team. And so I spend a lot of time both shooting as well as training and educating and speaking at conferences for the Fujifilm team and as a Holdfast gear ambassador. You mentioned it. I've got my hands in as many cookie jars as I can, not so that I can eat cookies, but so that I can just pour back into this industry it's treated me really well over the last 15 years. So now it's my turn to give back.
Well, I heard you say scotch earlier. Maybe scotch over cookies?
Scotch over cookies. Any day. Let's go.
Fair enough. Well, Miles, I do appreciate it. This has been a very interesting conversation and definitely kind of outside the typical approach that I have in our podcast, but I appreciate you pushing me too. And I hope that those listening in, if you've got questions, thoughts, ideas that go beyond just this individual episode today, that you'll make an effort to reach out to Miles or myself And we'd love to continue this conversation in some form or fashion. Of course, we'll link to all the resources that Miles mentioned at Miles, of course, I've got this up on screen right now, but mileswhitboyer.com and Instagram, Miles Whitboyer. And then we'll also link to the Photographic Collective as well, Miles. I appreciate you sharing that. Okay. And your effort to building community. I know it, from personal experience, it can be a pretty tough thing. And but at the end of the day, as you highlighted so beautifully earlier, if we're focused on serving, adding value to those around us, there's opportunity to make a really big impact, even if it's in a few people's lives. And I can see that you're doing that. So I appreciate you sharing that with us as well. Thanks, everybody, for listening in, for joining us today. Hope you have an absolutely beautiful week. Thanks again, Miles, for making time for all of us.
Man, thank you. Again soon. All right, buddy. Appreciate you.